Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. This event is going to be recorded for the college website and archive, so I just want you to know that that's going to be happening. I'm Wendy Schmaleski, the curator of the Swarthmore College Peace Collection and also a member of the Peace and Conflict Studies program here at Swarthmore. First, I'd like to thank our co-sponsors of this event, the Peace and Conflict Studies Program, the President's Office, the Swarthmore College Peace Collection, Friends Historical Library, the History Department, Political Science Department, Gender and Sexuality Studies, Women's Resource Center, the Lang Center for Social Responsibility, and the English Literature Department. Thank you to everybody there. Yay! Today's talk is one of the first events in honor of the celebration of the sesquicentennial of the college. And we're especially pleased to be part of this, noting the contributions of two Swarthmore College alumni to the cause of human rights, Mabel Vernon and Alice Paul, whose pictures you'll see here and hear more about today. I also want to mention that September 21st, this Saturday, is the 31st International Day of Peace, which is recognized by all United Nations member states. And the day is dedicated to world peace and the absence of war and violence. This talk is also officially part of the Philadelphia citywide celebration of Peace Day events. And if you want to know more about these events, you can go to the website peacedayphilly.org. Okay. Right now, when I was growing up and going to school in the 1960s and early 1970s, we barely learned about the long movement for women's rights in the United States. Maybe there was one or two paragraphs in our history textbooks mentioning two of the early movement leaders, Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. But the story ended rather quickly with just those couple of paragraphs with a ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution in August of 1920, and that's the amendment that gave women all over the United States the right to vote. We certainly didn't learn that the movement for women's civil rights, the right to vote, to be elected to office, to own property, to make contracts, sit on juries, the right to have an equal education and equal pay, or freedom from domestic and gender-based violence, has lasted for the entire history of the nation. There were no comparisons with the heroes of the American Revolution or the glorious history of rights demanded by the American colonists in the early years of the Republic when the Constitution and Bill of Rights were written and debated. This, despite the fact that Stanton and Lucretia Mott, one of the founders of Swarthmore College, and their colleagues who organized the first Women's Rights Convention in 1848, based their Declaration of Sentiments on the Declaration of Independence, demanding for all women the rights enjoyed by male citizens. We did not learn about the determination, dedication, resolve, courage, and political savvy of hundreds of thousands of women of all colors, ethnicities, and economic backgrounds across the United States who fought and continue to fight for their rights. We were told that these women were ridiculous, aggressive, strident, unfeminine, ugly, were only involved in the fight for their rights because they weren't married, or henpecked their husbands, or didn't have children, or didn't stay home, or wanted to push themselves into male preserves. I seem to remember in those long ago textbooks that we did learn about Carrie Nation, a famous leader of the temperance movement and a supporter of prohibition laws against the consumption of alcohol. She was portrayed as dangerous, destroying barrels of alcohol with her axe in the streets, old, wrinkled, and spoiling male fun in bars and saloons, as if this is what happened when women were allowed a role in determining social and public policy, that it would lead to violent, disruptive behavior. We wouldn't want to be like those women, would we? We can hope that our national understanding of the movement for women's civil rights has changed since the middle of the last century, when the first histories of this movement were being written. But I wonder, how many of us in the United States today celebrate or even know key figures or events in this long fight? Our speaker today, Mary Walton, has written a wonderful book about some of these women, Alice Paul and Mabel Vernon, their colleagues of the National Woman's Party, and the final years of the battle for women's suffrage nearly a century ago. But even relatively recently, as Mary relates in the author's note in her book, A Woman's Crusade, and here it is, and there'll be copies that you can get later and buy later and have signed by the author. She relates that her literary agent told her that women's history doesn't sell. Fortunately, Mary was not deterred by this pronouncement, and her agent was able to sell the book, after all, and to a major publisher, Palgrave Macmillan, at that. A Woman's Crusade has received rave reviews from readers, specialists, and the general public alike. After graduation from Harvard University and a turn at social work and community organizing, Mary Walton began her journalism career as a reporter at the Charleston, West Virginia Gazette. She worked for 20 years as a newspaper reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has also written for the New York Times, Washingtonian, the Washington Monthly, and the American Journalism Review. She is also the author of several other books, including For Love of Money and Carr, A Drama of the American Workplace. Mary writes that as a girl, she was inspired by Brenda Starr, the glamorous journalist portrayed in the comic strip of the same name. And I would guess she might now add Alice Paul and Mabel Vernon as sources of inspiration as well. Please welcome Mary Walton.
Thank you, Wendy, for that gracious introduction and for setting the stage so well for when it comes to Alice Paul and Mabel Vernon. My appreciation also to Lee Smithy for the invitation to be here. I'm really honored. It is a privilege to be here on the eve of Swarthmore's sesquicentennial, 150 years of excellence in education. And to you who are here, I say carry on and congratulations. And is Anna Everts here? I'd like to thank Anna Everts, who attended to all the little details. Actually, I'm using, is this, wave if you can't hear me and I'll speak more loudly. Attended to all the little details that make an event like this possible. Is this on too? Oh, I think it's on too. Okay, good. Okay. I can think of no more appropriate way to start off your sesquicentennial than with a talk about these two women, early graduates and very, very distinguished. Alice Paul was the leader of the militant wing of the women's suffrage movement from 1913 to 1920. She fought for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution giving women the country over the vote. This was the quintessential battle of one person against the odds. It was David against Goliath. It was the Rocky story. Alice took on the President of the United States and the United States Congress. But in the tactics she developed and deployed, she was more than just a fighter for suffrage. She was a pioneer in nonviolent resistance. She was to suffrage what Gandhi was to Indian independence, what Martin Luther King was to civil rights. Mabel Vernon was her most trusted organizer. Mabel was funny, Mabel was smart, Mabel was organized, very productive, and most importantly, Mabel was an extremely talented public speaker. This made her invaluable to Alice, whether she was talking on a street corner in Washington or out west holding forth from a town hall in Wyoming. So those were these two wonderful women. They come to Swarthmore. They come to Swarthmore. You recognize this building, I'm sure. This was Swarthmore. It was foreordained that Alice would come to Swarthmore. Her grandfather was instrumental in raising money for the college. Her mother had Casey Paul had come to Swarthmore, never graduated because she got married, and in those days you couldn't continue if you were married. The family was friends with Lucretia Mott, the great abolitionist and suffragist, and Swarthmore founder. More to the point, Swarthmore was coeducational. The other Quaker college in the area, Haverford, was not. But even though one of the founding principles of Swarthmore was coeducation, there were limits, as I'll read you. The Quakers viewed Swarthmore as an experiment to prove what has never yet been fully proven, that it is feasible and desirable to give to women equal educational facilities with men. It was one thing to provide both sexes with an education, however, and another to trust them with each other. The administration took the in loco parentis role to heart and fired the first president for being too soft on issues of moral propriety. His successor, Edward Hicks McGill, was famous for his 100 rules, of which perhaps the most famous of all was that students of the two sexes, except brothers and sisters, shall not walk together upon the grounds of the college, nor in the neighborhood, nor to or from the railroad station or the skating grounds. They shall not coast upon the same sled. Alice and Mabel meet, of course, at Swarthmore. Alice gets here first, arrives in 1901 at the age of 16. She's graduated from Moorestown Friends. Mabel, though older, comes later. She's a graduate of Wilmington Friends. Alice is eighth generation Quaker. Mabel, we know, was Quaker on her father's side, but raised as a Presbyterian. Well, came a time when Alice had to deliver a speech in a college-wide competition. Alice was terrified of public speaking. Mabel, by now, has quickly established a reputation as being possibly the best orator on the Swarthmore campus. So Alice goes to Mabel and asks Mabel to coach her, invites her to walk along Crum Creek together, where she makes this plea. And Mabel says yes. And Mabel does coach her. Mabel goes on to win first prize. She talks about racial equality. Alice makes it into the finals and survives, but does not win a prize. And again, when Alice graduates, she's given a great honor. She's named Ivy Poet, or Poetess. She has to write a poem, no problem there, and deliver it at graduation. Once again, she goes to Mabel. And I said, "Now will you train me so I can deliver my poem?" So she undertook very religiously to have me practice and practice and practice my poem. So when the day came, I think she had gotten me up to the point where probably people could hear me, and this great audience was there, and I gave my little Ivy poem. Mabel struck a blow for suffrage before she graduated. The portrait of Lucretia Mott that hung in the girls' parlor Mabel thought the frame had gotten shabby, so she took it upon herself to take down the portrait, take it into Philadelphia, have it reframed. And we think this is the portrait that hangs in the Friends Historical Library. So if you're in there and you see it, give a little nod of thanks to Mabel Vernon for rescuing it. Alice is raised on this farm in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Her father was a banker, but also a gentleman farmer, had the usual farm animals. You can see sheep on the lawn. She would have had to shoo them away because she liked to play tennis on that lawn. She loved that big veranda. She liked to read out there, play checkers with her siblings. She was the oldest of four children. She had a sister and two brothers. This was a strict Quaker household. There was no music in this home. The Quakers believed that music was at best a distraction, at worst quite possibly dangerous. And Alice said she never heard so much as a hymn until she went to Swarthmore. She was raised with good Quaker values. Someone said to me, are there any other kind? And that meant, above all, an belief in absolute equality, regardless of gender, regardless of race, regardless of social standing. The first Quakers in 17th century England refused to remove their hats in the presence of authority, because if you believe everyone is equal, no one is better than anyone else. So they wouldn't take off their hats to royalty or officials. And for this, they went to jail. Well, Alice would have known this history very well. She attended Quaker schools all her life, as I said, Moorestown Friends, and she went to school up the road in Moorestown, New Jersey. She rode a horse to school. This was not something that proper young ladies did in those days. And she rode that horse bareback, which really scandalized people. But then Alice was never quite a proper young lady. She graduates from Swarthmore, 1905, doesn't know what to do with herself. Options for women are limited. She can be a nurse. She can be a teacher. Mabel Vernon becomes a teacher. But a new profession has opened up, the profession of social work, heretofore done by volunteers. And the New York School of Philanthropy has opened, and that's actually giving training in social work. So Alice goes off to New York. She lives in a settlement house on the Lower East Side in a largely Jewish neighborhood. And it's here that she becomes acquainted firsthand with the problems women have in trying to take care of their families, poor women, problems of health care, housing, hunger. And Alice does what she can to help, but she's not impressed with social work because it doesn't really change anything, her word. Women, of course, couldn't vote. They couldn't lobby for change from legislators. They had no power. Alice returns to Pennsylvania. She goes to the University of Pennsylvania, gets her master's degree in sociology, and she goes off to England to continue her studies. And it is in England that she becomes associated with the militant suffragettes, the Women's Social and Political Union founded by this woman, Emmeline Pankhurst. Emmeline has just been arrested trying to storm the gates of Parliament to present a petition for suffrage. Women couldn't even get a hearing from Parliament. They couldn't speak at political meetings, so they did speak at political meetings, even Alice. And Alice would tell the story on herself years later, that she's at a meeting and she's waiting her turn to speak, terrified. And one by one, the speakers ahead of her get up, start to talk, and they're arrested. And it dawns on her, she's going to be arrested. She isn't going to have to speak after all. Great feeling of relief. And she did speak. And she was arrested. She was arrested 7 times this year, 1909, and she goes to jail 3 times. Toward the end of that year, women are asking to be treated as political prisoners, as men are. This means they can get mail, read newspapers, have visitors. They are turned down. So in protest, they go on hunger strikes. Well, the authorities don't want to see harm come to these women. They don't want to see them suffer. So they undertake to feed them. This woman's being held down. A tube goes from a funnel. The tube goes into her nostrils. Actually, sometimes it went into the stomach. It was more painful when it went into the nostrils. The food was generally raw eggs, liquid milk. But let me read you Alice's description. Twice daily, she was plucked from her cell, wrapped in blankets, and taken to a chair in another cell. A heavy woman, who she was certain must be the prison's largest matron, straddled her across the waist and leaned forward, pinning her shoulders down. 2 other matrons sat on either side, holding down her arms. Behind her stood a doctor, as she would later relate, who pulled my head back till it was parallel with the ground. He held it in this position by means of a towel drawn tightly around the throat, and when I tried to move, he drew the towel so tight that it compressed the windpipe and made it almost impossible to breathe. With his other hand, he held my chin in a rigid position. A second doctor pushed one end of a 5-foot-long tube into her nostril so hard that it felt as if he were driving a stake into the ground. Once the tube had reached her stomach, a funnel was positioned at the top, and milk and liquid food poured through. In subsequent feedings, more often than not, the tube would not reach its destination on the first try. In those cases, the doctor pulled it out, smeared it with thick grease, and tried the other nostril. 3 times the tube went astray and poked out through her mouth. Alice clamped her teeth down tightly, leaving the team no alternative but to pry her mouth open. While the tube is going through the nasal passage, it is exceedingly painful, and only less so as it is being withdrawn. I never went through it without the tears streaming down my face. By the end of that year, Alice decided that she had done enough for suffrage. She would come back to the United States and pursue her career in academia, wanted to be an academic. She comes back, it's the beginning of 1910, here she is on board ship arriving, and she enrolls at the University of Pennsylvania to continue her studies. Let me show you another poster. This was a poster shown at the 1893 World's Fair. Caused quite a stir. Upper left, language of the day was an idiot. Upper right, a convict. Bottom right, a lunatic. Bottom left, an Indian. In the middle, a woman. This is no, but what do you think these people had in common? Anybody? They can't vote, exactly. And this is no ordinary woman plucked off the street. This is Frances Willard, the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. The WCTU was very much in favor of suffrage. Well, the liquor lobby, fearing, you know, the temperance fighters were lobbying for prohibition, the liquor lobby doesn't want to see women vote, knowing they'll vote for prohibition. So whenever there's an election in a state, a vote on suffrage, the liquor lobby pours vast sums of money in to fight it. These are the distilleries, the breweries, the farmers who grow hops, the bars, people who like to drink. And the approach to suffrage is precisely to go state by state by state at this time. At the time of this poster, 1893, women could vote in just two states, Wyoming and Colorado. When Alice gets back, it's four states. They're all out west. Another problem with this state-by-state approach is that it took a vote by the state legislature to get the measure on the ballot for a referendum, all men. And then the voters would vote, all men, not really eager to give up power. So it was very slow going. Alice has a turn in Pennsylvania of organizing. Even though she's done with suffrage, she can't stay away. She recruits a woman named Lucy Burns, who she had met in England. They had been arrested together. Lucy's from Brooklyn. She has fiery red hair, a temperance to match. And Lucy comes back to help Alice in Philadelphia, and they organize the first street corner campaign. But Alice thinks it would be more effective to have a federal amendment that will give women the country over the vote, that it will be faster, more efficient. This amendment is not new. It's been around since 1887, voted on once in the Senate, never voted on again. Well, in 1912, the big national organization, suffrage organization of the day, is meeting in Philadelphia. And Alice goes to the leaders and said, if you will put me in charge, I will take over the campaign for the federal amendment. Well, they say, okay, two conditions. You have to raise your own money. You have to recruit your own supporters. Alice accepts the challenge. Lucy agrees to help. Alice goes off to Washington. It's the beginning of 1913. She rents this headquarters on F Street. F Street was the fashionable shopping street. So if women were parading up and down in their finery, maybe on their way to the great department store, Woodward and Lothrop, the advice went, don't get too close to that open doorway, or you're going to be pulled in and forced to do some volunteer work. There was plenty to do. Alice's first plan is to hold to organize a parade, the first suffrage parade in Washington, to take place on the day before Woodrow Wilson is inaugurated. March 4th in those days, her parade will be on March 3rd. And it's going to be on Pennsylvania Avenue, the great ceremonial thoroughfare sweeps from the White House to the Capitol. But first she needs a permit. The gentleman on the right, the police commissioner, Richard Sylvester, refuses. He says, there are going to be too many people in town on March 3rd. Well, yes, that's the reason. And furthermore, these are going to be Southern Democrats up to cheer one of their own, Wilson from Virginia. And they're going to be drinking. And Pennsylvania Avenue, no, it's too close to the Bowery District, home of bars and brothels. They're going to be celebrating in there. Well, Alice doesn't take no for an answer. She works the phone. Believe me, she would have loved social media. She has the phone. And she rallies the wives of prominent Washingtonians, congressmen, military men. She gets them behind her, and she goes to the press. Don't ask me how a young Quaker girl, Alice is 28, from Mount Laurel, New Jersey, knows how to work the press. But Alice was a public relations genius. And she wears Sylvester down. He caves in. She gets the day. She gets the route. This was the first real social protest parade in Washington. There'd been 1894, some maybe 500 unemployed men had marched up Pennsylvania Avenue in a demonstration. It did not go well. The leaders were arrested on the Capitol lawn for trespassing. Alice's parade is just a little different. Two dozen horse-drawn floats, nine bands, four mounted brigades, three heralds with trumpets, and at least 5,000 women, though possibly as many as 8,000, so many in any case that the organizers lost count. In caps and capes from dark to light came the social workers, teachers, businesswomen, and librarians. In three shades of rose, the artists, actresses, and musicians. On, a glorious cavalcade of color. Oh, just about this float, I call your attention to the word demand. Women didn't demand in those days. Women asked politely, they pleaded. Demand was an incendiary word. And she was putting Wilson on notice that the women expected results from his administration. So on with the parade, it's orderly, four abreast. But then what happens? Turns out Sylvester was right. The crowd broke through steel cables. They spilled into the path of the parade. They brought it to a halt. The men jeered at the women. They spit at them. They threw lighted cigarettes at them. They used their canes to knock off their hats, to lift the skirts of women on the floats. And the police who were supposed to keep order, turned their backs on the parade, and they were laughing like it was some kind of joke. And one told the women, if you hadn't come out today, this never would have happened. As one of Alice's supporters said, I did not know men could be such fiends. Well, it took a call to the cavalry across the river in Fort Myers to come galloping to the rescue and clear a path for the parade. You would think Alice would have been dismayed at what had happened to her beautiful parade, but she saw that this, on the front pages of newspapers across America, was a better story than her parade would ever have been. And she wrote a supporter, the police, this mistreatment by the police was probably the best thing that could ever have happened to us, as it aroused a great deal of public indignation and sympathy. So she thinks suffrage is right around the corner, but she knows it's going to take some work and she needs an organization. And her thoughts turn to her old friend, Mabel Vernon. Mabel is happily teaching German and Latin, I think, at Radnor High School. And Alice writes her to come to Washington. She has a job for her as an organizer. She writes, Mabel, I do hope very much that you will take up this work and let school teaching go. There are plenty of people to teach school. That was Alice. Nothing was more important than suffrage. And Mabel does take the job. And soon Mabel is speaking on street corners. This is 1913 into 1914. She and other young women are sent out west. Alice organizes two political campaigns, 1914 and 1916. She wants to harness the votes of women out west. And by now there are about 10 states where women can vote, but not many women. But Alice at least wants to send a signal to the Democrats in Congress, who are the ones holding up the vote. The Democrats, the Southern Democrats. The Southern Democrats don't want to see their women folk indulging in the messy business of politics. They belong at home with the family. More than that, the Southern Democrats don't want to see black women voting. Black men have had the vote since shortly after the Civil War under the 15th Amendment. They don't want to see the size of the black electorate double. And they're very open about that. These are busy years, rallies, lobbying, all kinds of activity. Whoops, just want to tell you one more thing about Mabel, important. Mabel loved political stunts. And she started to really dog Wilson in 1916 and interrupt his speeches. and was really beginning to make a name for herself in that regard. But probably the most notorious episode was Wilson was reelected in 1916. So he's giving his first speech to Congress after his reelection. And Mabel and Lucy Burns and three other women want to be there in the audience, and they get tickets from friendly congressmen. They arrive very early to get good seats. Mabel is quite visibly pregnant, big brown coat. So a guard makes sure that they're sitting in the front row in the very best seats of the balcony. So there they are. Wilson starts a speech, and they're waiting for Wilson to talk about voting rights for Puerto Rican men. That's the cue. And when he begins, Mabel spreads open this voluminous coat. They spread out a banner, and they drape it over the balcony. And there's all this commotion in Congress, and Wilson looks up to see, "Mr. President, how long must women wait? Mr. President, what will you do for women's suffrage?" And he goes right back to reading his speech. A page jumps up, and he pulls down the banner. And Mabel would always regret that the cords on the banner were so long. Because she said, "If it hadn't been for those long tapes, they could never have gotten it until the president finished his speech." But this picture is taken right after his speech. Yes, that's Mabel in the middle. She's pretty happy about the way it went down. The Associated Press calls this the first organized show of militancy in the nation's capital. By 1917, the women, however, have to face the fact that they haven't accomplished much. Something new is needed. Some way to really focus on Wilson, who's the head of the Democratic Party, to bring those stubborn Democrats around. Wilson takes the position it's a state's rights issue. Each state can determine its course. There have been many meetings with Wilson, and he sticks to that line. He'll have it no other way. On January 10th, 1917, a dozen women march out, cross Lafayette Square, and they take up positions at the gates, on either side of the gates of the White House. They just hold up banners. They don't speak, they don't chant, and they don't move. Well, Wilson is walking through ignoring the women, but I assure you the women were not ignored. People came down to see these curious women. These weren't the kind of women you would expect to be on a picket line. Well-bred, well-dressed, professionals, wives of professionals, college women. They were quite the curiosity. And Wilson might ignore them, but the press did not. The press was generally pretty hostile. The women called themselves silent sentinels. The New York Times called them silly, silent, and offensive. Tacy Paul, Alice's mother, writes her, "Dear Alice, I wish to make a protest against the methods you are adopting in annoying the president. Surely the Congressional Union, her organization, will not gain converts by such undignified actions. I hope thee will call it off." Alice does not call it off. They pick it into the cold winter. I always, in this photo, always look at their feet. Thin leather shoes, no nice warm UGG boots. They pick it in all kinds of weather. They pick it into the hot summer. Here's Mabel Vernon picketing. Notice, though, that she's flanked by this large crowd, and not a particularly friendly crowd, a male crowd. Well, by summer 1917, we're at war in Europe. And suddenly these women who were regarded as a nuisance, offensive, are something more. They're picketing a sitting president. They're disloyal, and maybe even they're traitors. One one sign, because now their signs are growing more strident. This was called the Russian Banner. We were trying to get Russia, which had had its revolution, to come into the side of the Allies. And two envoys were coming to Russia that day, and the women come out with this sign, and it says, President Wilson and Envoy Root are deceiving Russia. They say we are a democracy. Help us win a world war so that democracies may survive. We, the women of America, tell you that America is not a democracy. 20 million American women are denied the right to vote. President Wilson is the chief opponent of their national enfranchisement. They are attacking Wilson, the man who would, president who would make the world safe for democracy. They have gone too far. Mobs gather, objects are thrown at the women, their banners are torn down from their poles, the women are hurled to the ground. And this goes on not once, but on a daily basis. Well, clearly, action has to be taken against the perpetrators. That would be the women. They are arrested. Here are two of the suffragists being hauled off to police court. But now the authorities, it's a matron in the middle, now the authorities have a problem of what to charge them with. They're on that very wide White House sidewalk, not taking up much space. They are charged with obstruction of traffic. It's a misdemeanor. The first sentences are very light. But the women continue. They come out of jail. Oh, and Mabel is one of the first to be arrested. And the story about her is that she gets to district jail, and she spies an organ. So she asks the warden, well, could I play a hymn? And the warden sees something, nothing wrong with that. So she plays, God be with you till we meet again. And then she plays another hymn, and then she gives a rousing speech about suffrage. And all the prisoners, female prisoners, are there. And a prisoner is heard by a reporter to say, well, I can tell you one thing. When we get the vote, we're really going to make the men suffer. I loved Mabel. Everybody loved Mabel. Well, the women come out of prison. They go right back on the picket line. Now they're repeat offenders. And their sentences grow longer. The leaders are told they'll get 6 months. They do get 6 months. Here's Lucy Burns, 6 months. Alice is told, you're going to get 6 months, you leaders, and she goes right back out with a banner. You can't read it, but it says, the time has come to either conquer or submit. There is but one choice. We have made it. She somehow manages to pull 7 months. She, as she had in England, learned in England, asked to be treated as a political prisoner, denied, goes on a hunger strike. She and her followers, once again, are force-fed, knowing full well what was in store for them. She says, though, it's even worse than in England. In England, they fed you twice a day. Here, it's three times a day. The treatment of the women is particularly bad in a Maryland workhouse where they'd sent, where it's called Occoquan. The food is so awful. Soup, oatmeal with worms floating in it. They made a game out of counting the worms, 15 in one meal. Dry cornbread, rotten vegetables, only water to drink. And on one particular night toward in November, and things are really kind of building toward an end, 30 women are arrested and sent to Occoquan. They refuse to give their names. The warden orders them thrown into the men's punishment cells. Tobacco spit on the floor, cold stone floors, linens on these bear cots, these filthy linens never washed, vermin, rats, flies. The the warden is tells them they cannot speak. Lucy Burns calls out to her fellow prisoners to see if they're safe, and he orders her handcuffed to her cell. She spends much of the night like this. Well, the press knew about these conditions and did not report them. They had made an agreement with the Wilson administration not to describe the treatment of the suffragists. But word leaked out, and a socialist newspaper in New York got hold of this information and published it. And this wave of sympathy grew for women throughout the country. Because even if you disagreed with the picketing, many did, you had to recognize these women were brave, and many thought their cause to be just. Pressure builds on Wilson to do something. And at the same time, the National, that big suffrage organization, has not been idle. And in 1917, that same year, November, New York gets the vote. Suddenly, 50 congressmen have to vote for suffrage, or they're not going to be reelected. Remaining congressmen are very worried. They go to Wilson, what should we do? And Wilson changes his mind. Oh, it's not states' rights. This is a federal amendment. It's really a national issue. And other great democracies are given women the vote. Canada, England. How can we be left behind? He tells them to vote for suffrage. Even so, it takes another year and a half before the amendment passes both houses of Congress. And then it has to be ratified. Ratified by 3/4 of the states, 36 states. This is not a foregone conclusion. You're never going to get the South. A lot of governors won't call the state legislatures, which met many of them only every other year, into session, and it's very slow going. Alice has the ratification banner. She sews on a star for every state that ratifies, and by the summer of 1920, they've got 35 states. They need 36, one more. It comes down to Tennessee. Well, Tennessee is a border state. Tennessee also has a very powerful liquor lobby. And even though the 18th Amendment is passed for prohibition, the liquor lobby wants to reverse it. So they're still opposed to suffrage, and they pour money into Tennessee. The state Senate passes it, but the legislature is tied, 48-48. And we know this because there's a motion to table, and there's that tie vote on the motion to table. Well, even with a tie vote, the ratification can go to a vote, but if it doesn't pass, if there's no majority, it's lost. So it's not looking good. They go down the roll. And they get to the B's, and they get to the youngest member of the legislature, Harry Byrne. And Harry had voted for the motion to table, so he's going to vote again for against the amendment itself. But he doesn't. He raises his hand and votes aye. And the place goes wild. The women know they've won, and they sing, and they hug each other. And they hug the legislators, and they're just overjoyed, as you can imagine. And word travels back to Washington. Alice takes that ratification banner and drapes it over the railing of suffrage headquarters. Her volunteers are applauding. And Harry Byrne is asked, well, why did you change your mind? And he says, well, I got a note from my mother. True story, he says. She wrote, hurrah and vote for suffrage, and don't keep them in doubt. And he says, a boy should always listen to what his mother says. A great victory. Alice votes the election of 1920. She votes absentee ballot. That's Alice on the right. taking the oath of her oath is one of her supporters and also one of the first, if not the first, female notary publics. A great moment for them both. This is not the end of Alice's battle, however. She sees that the battle ahead is a legal one, that there are many laws in the states that, and federal laws as well, that discriminate against women. And so she decides she needs a law degree. Being Alice, she gets her bachelor's, master's, and doctorate of laws, and she goes to work on that legislation. She writes the ERA, and it's introduced in 1923, and every year thereafter. She's instrumental in getting language into treaties, international treaties, the United Nations Charter. She plays a role in the 1964 Civil Rights Act, guaranteeing gender equality in employment. So these are not idle years for Alice. But by old age, I mean, her fame is nothing like it was when she was on front pages of newspapers across America. And by old age, she's fallen into obscurity and poverty. But then comes the second wave feminists who rediscover Alice. And they find her in the nursing home in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. And they come to sit at her knees and talk to her and listen to the wisdom she has to offer. Alice lives to be 92. She dies in 1977. And let us not forget Mabel Vernon. Mabel Vernon, too, went back to school, got a degree in political science from Columbia in 1923, worked for the ERA until 1930, and then she decided that peace and disarmament needed her more, and she enlisted in the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom and pursued those issues until her death. Her papers are here at Swarthmore. Two just such remarkable women. I told you at the outset that Alice was a leader in nonviolent resistance, and I want to come back to that. If you think about that parade, the first social protest parade in Washington, the first people ever to picket the White House, those charges of obstruction of justice thrown out by a federal appeals court, permits given that were never given before to demonstrate in public places. Alice and her followers really opened up Washington to generations of protesters to come. Civil rights demonstrators, Vietnam War demonstrators, Tea Party protesters, all really owe a vote of thanks to Alice Paul, because she was there first. I always like to close with a quote from Gandhi, talking about movements of nonviolent resistance. And he once famously said, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win." Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Alice Paul.